Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. And if it's Friday, guess what? It means we make the schlep to Texas. Why? Because we want to hang out with Scott Braddock, who is the editor of the Quam Report, also known as the voice of Texas and the dean of the Austin Press Corps. Every time I talk to you, Scott, I feel like it hasn't been a week, it's been a year.
Yeah, a lot of things have happened.
So much is happening in a way that...
Welcome to 2021.
Oh, yeah, welcome to 20...
Exactly. Welcome to 2022.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. But we were waiting to hear who would be involved in the impeachment of Donald Trump. And that was, what was Nancy Pelosi going to pick for the impeachment managers? We know they just walked the articles of impeachment over this week. We know that we tape on Thursday morning so that we know that the members of the United States Senate are being sworn in by the Chief Justice. But what is so interesting is not only the decision that Nancy made in who she chose as her impeachment managers. It was actually a small knit group, only around six people. It was diverse in many ways. It was geographically diverse. It was racially diverse, but there was a theme in why she chose what she chose, and that is that they had to have some kind of skill set when it came to prosecution. But the Houston congresswoman...
I think they also needed to be in safe Democratic districts, but...
Yes, no. That's totally appropriate as well.
Yeah.
This is...
We have some here.
This is... I know you do. This is intimate to Houston because the Houston congresswoman, Sylvia Garcia, was chosen as one of the impeachment managers. She, however, is interesting. She does not have a law degree. Why don't you describe a little bit about your knowledge of... Congresswoman Garcia, because as you pointed out, you've known her for many, many years.
Oh, yeah, going back at least 15 years. Mm-hmm. She was Harris County Commissioner at the time. The governing body for counties in Texas is the Commissioner's Court, and she was there. She was also a judge, and, you know, she did some legal work, but like you say, didn't have a law degree. Mm-hmm. And Commissioner Garcia, one of the sort of Democratic bosses in Houston, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to get elected to anything in the East End of Houston years ago, you know, you were going to kiss the ring of Commissioner Garcia. She ran for Texas Senate. She was a state senator for a little while, I believe for a term before she then ran for Congress after a seat was vacated by a longtime member there in the Houston area. And you know, Arnie, it's interesting, and Julian Castro said this after he dropped out of the race, right? And he had been saying a version of this while he was still running for president. But when Democrats engage in gerrymandering, and when Democrats do things that are maybe sort of keeping the boots on the necks of certain people,
mm-hmm.
that should be called out too.
Yes,
because you can't do it to Republicans if your party is doing it.
I agree.
If you think about it this way. You know, she was just elected to Congress a couple of years ago. Texas, which has the largest population of, you know, right alongside California, of Latinos in the United States. In that election cycle a couple of years ago, Veronica Escobar from El Paso, Texas, and Sylvia Garcia from Houston, Texas, became the first Latinas elected to Congress from this state. How is it possible that only, well, you know, those districts were drawn for white Democrats, you know, that where she came from. So, interesting, she's made her way into this position now, and I think she, just like some of the other members in these committees, of course, she played a key role asking questions of witnesses during these committee hearings on the impeachment and the articles of impeachment. She said that, look, her second year in Congress, it's off to a hell of a start. That was the quote.
Uh-huh.
And she'll be right there alongside these others prosecuting the President of the United States. She said, here was the quote from her. She said, it's sort of a mix of awesome along with being somber and sad because you don't really want to, you know, see this kind of thing unfold, but when it's necessary, you have to do your job.
Let me go back to something you said because I'm a little confused here. So you were talking about gerrymandering and that Julian said what I totally agree with, which is that when Democrats do it, they need to be called out just like Republicans. That is the difference between Republicans and Democrats, by the way. Republicans basically move lockstep and say, we love gerrymandering. We think it's phenomenal. And then Democrats say, we don't like it. We'd like to change it. And then when they don't change it, they then want to call people out when they, you know, participate in partisan gerrymandering. So you were describing Garcia's district. Was it initially gerrymandered for white Republicans and because of the changing demographic?
No, it was
okay,
it was
that's what I'm trying to
say. White Democrat. The white Democrat, Jean Greene, who was there previously, eventually retired. But there was no chance that anybody who was a minority was going to take that seat as long as he wanted to be there. So that sort of thing has gone on all over the South, quite frankly. And by the way, these arguments are just fascinating, because when you talk about the idea that that is a majority Hispanic district, and it had become that way
over
the time the congressman was there, the Hispanic leadership in the area would tell you that, look, when we talk about choosing, you know, the candidate that we feel will best represent our interests, it doesn't mean the person has to be Latino. It
of
just
course.
Means it's the person who's going to, you know, represent us and the issues that are important to us. And so a lot of those Latino leaders would continue to stick with the white incumbent, even when he had Hispanic challengers. And so it's interesting. You've seen a tipping. My point is, you've seen a real tipping point happen where that can't happen in those districts anymore. As soon
because
as those
overwhelmingly
old guard
Hispanic
incumbents are out, the next generation coming in is going to be those minorities.
You know, this is so interesting, because in a lot of ways you're mirroring what I said the other day on TV about Joe Biden, that Joe Biden is so embraced by the black community. You see that with his numbers in South Carolina. There's a level of familiarity. Obviously, he was Barack Obama's VP. There's this sort of idea that this is what we can get. This is what we know. Therefore, you know, look what happened to Cory Booker. Look what happened to Kamala Harris. They could not get any traction. And one of the things I said, and you've heard me say this before, is about a year and a half ago, I didn't want Biden or Bernie to run. And this is actually
that didn't work out, Arnie.
It didn't. But you're making my point.
Yeah.
If Biden and Bernie had not decided to run,
would there still be on that debate stage?
Right. Would Cory Booker still be on the debate stage? Would Kamala Harris still be on the debate stage? Would South Carolinians be looking at someone of color as a potential candidate for president of the United States?
Right.
And that's part of the problem. You've got these old white boomers who've been around forever, you know, who've been in the political arena for decades. Mm-hmm. And while there's a level of familiarity, you may have some authenticity, yada, 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 the quote unquote experience thing. At the same time, wasn't this an opportunity in 2020 to refresh the bench? And unfortunately, we have not done that.
In refreshing the bench, just to shift gears on you just slightly, I mentioned in the email I sent you this morning that I was going to talk about Texas House races. In Houston, Texas, there is a fascinating thing happening where you have a lot of old guard African-American Democratic members of the Texas House who have been there for decades, you know, going back to, one of them almost 50 years.
Okay.
And all of them have drawn primary challengers from younger upstart candidates. And it's not a racial shift, but a generational shift.
Yeah.
They want to get the old guard out of there. And there's this real squeeze going on, Arnie. It's people who are not millennials, but people who are a little bit older than that. I guess Gen X is the right thing to say. And the Gen Xers are now looking at it like there are these folks who have been in office for so long that they don't really represent, at least in their estimation, they don't really represent the population of the area anymore, because you do have some differences generationally, and they're looking down, Arnie, you know, coming up, you know, behind them is the millennials, there's so many of them, that at some point they'll all be running for office, and the Gen Xer types are saying, well, you know, if I don't run now, if I don't go for it now, I'll never get to, you know, have a seat at the
table. It'll miss my generation. It'll miss my generation. Exactly.
Absolutely. Very interesting. So we'll see. I'm going to keep a close eye on those primaries in Houston and see how that goes. But it may end up being, you know, we get a lot of questions here about the primary happening in South Texas. So Congressman Henry Cuellar and Jessica Cisneros, the sort of progressive, they were calling her the next AOC, which I don't agree with that. But anyway, we get a lot of questions from national media about that. And I think what's happening in Houston is more analogous to what happened with AOC and the establishment Democrat that she took out in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
Because, look, for one thing, in South Texas, Democrats, it's not the same kind of Democrat that you're thinking of. In South Texas, you're talking about people who would call themselves pro-life, talking about people who, when it comes to guns, if you ask a South Texas Democrat, do they support gun control or not, they might look at you crossways. That's not the right question. The right question when you're talking to a South Texas Democrat is, how many guns do you own? And on climate change, they have a completely different attitude. But what's happening in Houston is this generational frustration, if you will. They want to see a fresh crop. They want to see, you know, new folks come in. And so I think this year's kind of test that.
Well, you know, I mean, I've been disabused on term limits. I used to be opposed to term limits, and I'm not anymore.
Yeah, I hear all about it.
And I just I actually think that
was that it, when you were in office, you were against it.
Well, actually. No. To be honest with you.
I'm just giving you a hard
No. To be honest with you, I mean, I served for 8 years. I then ran for governor. People begged me to go back. People begged me to run again. And I said no. I said I opened a door. I walked through that door. There's someone else behind me. You know, and I'm not the only one that has virtue. I'm not the only one that can actually obtain some institutional memory. I'm not the only one. And frankly, we do need to refresh the bench. We do need to know my state is changing demographically. I want to reflect that change in the New Hampshire legislature. We can't if we're there for 27 years. I'm sorry. Right. But, you know, I'm wondering how some of these new people are running against the incumbents, because I think what you need to say to voters isn't that you don't value their history and their experience. You know, and that you sort of recognize that they had a role to play. But given the fact that we're just talking about how things are galloping in the way of change, and Texas is changing so dramatically, even demographically, let alone maybe even politically in 2020, what you're saying is this is not a negative on them, but it is a reflection of what is our collective future. And I think that's a really hard thing to fight, because how do you say as an incumbent you hate that person for saying it? Because to a large extent, isn't that why you want to participate, is to open a door for the future? Well, when do you decide to do that?
Right. And yeah, I had a friend who was in the Texas House, a Republican member of the House, who was there for 20 years, and he decided to retire. And it was an interesting one, Arnie, because he could have run again and probably would have won. He always, you know, the Republican primaries were getting nastier, and he was still able to win in his district outside Fort Worth with about 55%. In a Republican primary, and then, of course, the Democrat, if there even was one, would get destroyed. But he left after 20 years, and I asked him, well, why did you hang it up? You know, why did you decide to go? And he said, well, you know, when you're doing this thing, and, you know, sort of, he was just a good old boy, he'd say, you know, people keep asking you when you're running, you know, what is it that you have left to do down there? And at some point, it just becomes impossible to ask that to answer that question.
Right.
You know, at some point, you've done your part, and it's time for other people to do their part.
Right. I just want to remind everyone that public service is not permanent service. Okay? It's really important. And that the idea of public service was that it would constantly be changing, because the publics are changing and the needs of those publics are changing. So let's go into something that I thought was really fascinating. So Governor Abbott was the first governor in the country to basically refuse refugees.
I think we're still the only one.
The only one. Okay, the first.
I think so.
This point. All right.
I haven't checked in the last 10
months. Well, you know,
although you saw there was a court this week that said that the administration cannot
make that decision. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But what I thought is more fascinating is that Senator Cornyn disagreed publicly with Governor Greg Abbott about that decision. Now, first of all, let's talk about how many refugees are we talking about that have been accepted by Texas. I know it's more than any other state, but Texas is like the size of a country. We are not talking thousands and thousands. I think, aren't we talking about like 2,500?
Well, thousands and thousands over the years, yes.
Over the years, yeah,
like,
yeah.
But the numbers are more like you say. Now, Texas does have, I would like to say, the history of being the state that accepts the most refugees, in Houston in particular.
Right.
In Houston, the school that used to be called Robert E. Lee High School is now called Wisdom High School, and it has the highest proportion of refugees of any public school in the United States, kids from Iraq, kids from Syria, et cetera, war-torn places, and we have a long, proud history of taking them in. By the way, the word Texas translates to friend.
Okay. Wow, so, I didn't know that. Thank you for that nugget.
We've always been openly welcoming of all these folks. It's a long part of our history. The people who settled Texas were refugees. So Texas Senator Cornyn said he didn't agree with what Abbott had said. And I'll just refresh the memory of the listeners. Abbott had put in his letter letting the administration know that this state was not going to participate in refugee resettlement. He had said that we face, quote, a disproportionate amount of the migration issues in this country resulting from a broken federal immigration system, and that Texas has already welcomed, quote, more than its share of immigrants and asylum seekers into the state. Cornyn was asked about it, and he said, quote, and by the way,
Cornyn is running for, let me just remind my audience, Cornyn is running for re-election.
He's on the ballot.
He's on the ballot in 2020, so this is important to remember. Okay, keep going.
It is important. And by the way, I will also say, I didn't see one major elected Republican praise the governor for this decision, not even the lieutenant governor, who is, you know, sort of the spiritual leader of the conservative movement in Texas. John Cornyn said, quote, "I think I understand what his concern is. We've got this flood of asylum seekers coming into Texas, which has burdened our public education, health care, and law enforcement institutions. So I think he feels we've borne the brunt of that, and so he's unwilling to take on additional burden." But then he went on to say, "I would like to have a private conversation with him to understand his thinking on this. I don't agree with it." Look, we've got the resources in this state to help people. Here's the comparison I would make, Arnie. We call people refugees if they come from some other country, but back in 2005, there was a hurricane. You might remember it was called Hurricane Katrina. It hit New Orleans. It was supposed to hit Houston, and it tracked to the east and hit New Orleans. And so thousands and thousands of people came from Louisiana into Texas.
I remember.
And I was there at the Astrodome when they set it up, and Barbara Bush was there, and she told me that you know, these folks had it better in that shelter than they had it back in their homes. I think that comment was misconstrued by some people, but it did go viral. I've got the political cartoon on my wall of that. It was in the Washington Post. But anyway, all these people came in. We took care of these folks. You saw for miles and miles cars of Texans lined up with water, clothes, food, everything that people needed to be able to be comfortable here in Texas. We welcomed them on in. And every time I've seen one of these disasters play out, whether it was hurricanes, fires, etc., anytime people could not be in their homes, the longest line in Texas is not the one to get free stuff. The longest line in Texas is the one
stuff.
To volunteer to help.
Yes, yes, yes.
So this is just a shameful decision. I had heard this morning that, and I can tell you this on the radio, several sources close to the governor are telling me that he is looking for some way to try to walk this back without looking like he really stepped in it. The fact that the court did step in and say that the administration is not allowed to let the states opt out of refugee resettlement, that may give him some cover to just walk this back and say we're not going to pursue this anymore. But it would be very rare for Governor Abbott to admit he'd made a mistake and go a different direction.
And let me just also remind people, and I think I'm correct about this, that if you are defined as a, quote, refugee and you're assigned to a different state, whatever, that there's a cash assistance program that helps refugees. So unlike other sort of immigration issues, refugees are in sort of an island of their own. So they get support. They get support from the government. They get support for a year or two or three. This is a very, very sort of different group of individuals. So for him to have targeted this group really didn't make sense. I know the numbers, you know, are that he can say we've accepted more than any other, you know, state in the nation. But when you actually look at, you know, who's coming in, what the status of these individuals that are coming in, and the kind of supports they're getting as they come in, they really are set apart.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't think people know that. And I just think it's important that people be aware that that's also part of the definitional thing. Now, I want to make sure that we grab this before you leave. You said taxpayer-funded gun locks are free to Texans unless they have the wrong political agenda. Okay, put me into therapy. What the hell does that mean?
Well, this was an exclusive from Hearst Newspapers here. The San Antonio Express News got some emails and reported on this. The governor had announced a $1 million grant to try to pass out 625,000 free gun locks after these mass shootings that we had in Texas and El Paso and Midland, Odessa. And there was, I see if I can read from this email for you. There was an email exchange. It seemed like, and by the way, Arnie, this is why the gun thing is just so disappointing as a debate. There can't ever be any common ground. There was a person who's with a gun, you know, sort of a gun safety group who wanted to get some of these gun locks, and this group called the National Shooting Sports Foundation had voiced concerns to Abbott's office that any such association with anybody who was, you know, any kind of gun control advocate would not look good. So here's what the email said.
Okay.
Quote, "While I respect these people and their clear commitment to firearm safety, their alignment with Project Child Safe," which is not some insane group, "their alignment with Project Child Safe and their locks could cause controversy given the political agenda and alienate gun owners and those with whom we have the most capacity to affect change. So, you know, any time, it's just...
Wait, so translate this. This is I feel like I'm following a worm. So what you're saying is that they created this opportunity to give free gun locks. But the free gun locks can't go to people who actually embrace the concept of gun control or gun safety.
Yeah,
because it would contaminate
this effort.
Oh, my God.
It's because... And this is the same exact thing, and yeah, that's the detail of it, but exact thing that the lieutenant governor of Texas ran into this summer. You remember last summer, you remember that Dan Patrick came out strongly and said he wanted to, quote, buck the NRA and advocate for some gun control. Now, the policy prescription he was actually talking about was
tepid. Exactly.
A small baby step, if you will. He was talking about background checks on stranger-to-stranger sales,
mm-hmm.
which some folks asked, like, if I take you to coffee and talk to you about guns for a half hour, are we strangers anymore? So, gun. So, anyway, he talked about that, and he got so much backlash from conservative groups, from Republican primary voters. He's backed off that. He's not talking about it anymore. And we get it. What has happened here? It's because Patrick and others forever have said that any kind of gun control means what? That they're going to take your gun away from you, and there's no in-between. And I know you're in a big gun state there in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
We're in a big gun state here in Texas. It's part of our culture and all that sort of stuff. It's very unfortunate that there can never be any sort of reasonable discussion or groups that don't necessarily align politically working together to try to make sure the children are safer in homes in the state.
Yeah, we just had a big fight about the red flag laws. So, I mean, I totally get what's going on here. And you would think it's a no-brainer, the red flag laws. But it turns out that, you know, the question is, well, when do you give them their guns back and what happened? I mean, it is unbelievable that you can't bring up anything vis-a-vis a gun without being accused of, you know, bucking the NRA. And yet at the same time, I think this is what is so challenging. But again, the changing demographic is going to change the conversation. Right. You know, and we see a template for that. I recommend an article by Paul Waldman. I believe he wrote it at the Washington Post, where he looked at the challenge facing Virginia. Because Virginia used to be a reliably red state. It has now become a blue state. And right. Part of becoming a blue state is the governor wants to remove guns from the state capitol. Oh, my God. What do you mean? And now they're talking about some gun controls, because that really reflects what the legislature was they were elected to do. And yet, you know, people who have been there forever say, no, this is a pro-gun state. What are you talking about? And just playing out the tension in Virginia really gives you an idea of what the challenge is going into the future. It's an amazing article. I definitely recommend it. Now, before I let you go, there is this talk that there will be change in Texas in 2020. The way to fight that change is obviously through fundraising and making sure Republicans have the resources they need. One of the things I want to remind everyone was I talked on a radio show the other day about the first state in the nation where gazillionaire Michael Bloomberg decided to do his first bus tour. Where was it? Oh, shock of shocks. I believe it began in Austin, Texas. And he started spending his millions in Texas. So I think Republicans have to be scared, because not only do they have to sort of raise their money knowing that Democrats are also beginning to attract big dollars, but now you've got a guy who has an unlimited checkbook. And where does he decide to throw some of his first cash? In Texas. Michael.
Great point, Arnie. Yeah, he did his bus tour. He was traveling along what has been called the blue spine of Texas, the I-35 corridor from Austin up to DFW in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I'm looking at the campaign finance reports for the Texas House, Texas Senate, some of the congressional races as well. Democrats are coming in hot with a lot of money, and it's not that Republicans don't have money, but what's interesting is it seems to be a disjointed effort. On the Republican side, I was looking at the fact that a couple hundred thousand was donated to the Texas House GOP caucus as they try to protect members. And then there's also a PAC that was launched in with the assistance of Karl Rove, who, of course, you know.
Of course.
who has said that he's going to work overtime to try to preserve the Texas House majority, which is just 9 seats away from flipping to the Democrats.
Very important.
We got their report this morning. And when they first announced, Arnie, that they were going to have this effort to try to protect Republicans, the goal would be to raise about $5 million. And it's still early, and so I want to preface this with that. But the number that they reported on hand seemed a little underwhelming, and insiders in Austin are certainly saying it's an underwhelming number. With a $5 million goal, so far they have raised about $505,000, and they have $480,000 on hand. And again, it's not that they don't have money. There's a disjointed effort, and this is a natural consequence of having a Speaker of the House who threw the institution under the bus in the scandal.
Exactly.
No one trusts him to direct the funding, which is what speakers in this state have done, going back to Joe Strauss, going back before that. You know, their first standing order is to protect the members. And so millions of dollars would have been directed by a Speaker Joe Strauss years ago. Dennis Bonin, the disgraced Speaker, still sitting on $3 million in his PAC, and we'll see if he, in the estimation of some Republicans, does the right thing and hands over his cash to one of these other groups that can be trusted to allocate resources.
Wow, it's going to be such an interesting year. I know you've been under the weather, so I need to thank you
so
much.
I'm just about out of voice here, Arnie.
Yeah, I can tell. I can tell.
I'm leaving it all on the field for you.
I love you. I love you. Lemon and honey. Lemon and honey. And on that note, this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Scott Braddock, because after all, how can you do Fridays without going to Texas? Thank you so much and feel better.
Talk to you soon.
Okay, ciao. Bye-bye. All right, everyone, stick around. I'm going to do a little reading. Trust me, I'm going to do a lot of reading. You'll find out.
You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are six or seven or eight, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be carefully taught.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. I haven't done this in a long time, folks, so either forgive me or kick back and enjoy it. You know how they have books on tape, and occasionally if you listen to public radio, there's the New Yorker group that comes on and talks about some of the articles and columns that they've written at the New Yorker, and they interview the reporters. Well, I saw two articles, and I realized that they are so important that not only do I want to make sure that at some point in time we can interview the authors of these articles, which we will do and which we have done, but that you actually hear every word that was written in their piece. I am a big proponent of universal health care, of single payer, of a version of Medicare for all. But the goal really is to get everyone not just access to health care, but coverage. Because in the end, you don't walk into a hospital and say, "So what's wrong with you?" And you say, "I don't have insurance." What you want to do is walk into a hospital and say, "I broke my arm." Okay. And I mean, the problem is we have conflated insurance with healthcare, and it's not the same. One is for profit and the other one is to heal. Okay. And I saw an article in the New York Times by Wendell Potter, and it was written on January 14th. And I contacted Wendell Potter's people and I said, "Do I have permission from Mr. Potter to read his article out loud to my radio audience?" And they said, "We would be delighted, and please invite Wendell to come on your show." What they didn't know at the time was I've actually had Wendell Potter on my show, but many, many years ago. And what makes Wendell Potter so interesting is in a lot of ways, he's kind of a whistleblower. He is a former vice president for corporate communications at Cigna and is president of Business for Medicare for All and Medicare for All Now. So he comes from the belly of the insurance beast, which means he understands how they processed, how they played things out, how they sold ideas to the American people. He also understands why the insurance model is probably not the best model if you care about healthcare in this country. So his piece that he wrote was How the Health Insurance Industry and I, because as I mentioned to you before, he worked for Cigna, invented the choice talking point. And the subtitle of this piece at the New York Times from January 14th was, "It was always misleading." And then this is the real kick. "Now Democrats are repeating it." Ooh, ooh. All right, everyone. Once I read this, you will understand why I grabbed it and wanted permission to read it to my audience. He begins this way. "There's a dangerous talking point being repeated in the Democratic primary for president that could affect the survival of millions of people and the finances of even more. Sadly, this is partly my fault. When the candidates discuss health care, you're bound to hear some of them talk about consumer choice. If the nation adopts systemic health care reform, this idea goes, it would restrict the ability of Americans to choose their plans or their doctors or actually have a say in their care." Yeah. It's a good little talking point in that it makes the idea of changing the current system sound scary and limiting. Here's the problem. It's a PR concoction. God, do I know that. And right now, somewhere in their plush corporate offices, some healthcare industry executives are probably beside themselves with glee, drinking a toast to their public relations triumph. I should know. I was one of them, writes Wendell Potter. To my everlasting regret, I played a hand in devising this deceptive talking point about choice when I worked in various communications roles for a leading health insurer between 1993 and 2008, ultimately serving as, guess his job, vice president for corporate communications. So he knows what he owns, everyone. Now I want to come clean by explaining its origin story and why it's both factually inaccurate and, more importantly, a political ploy. Those of us in the insurance industry constantly hustled to prevent significant reforms because changes threatened to eat into our company's enormous profits. We were told by our opinion research firms and messaging consultants that when we promoted the purported benefits of the status quo, that we should talk about the concept of choice. It, after all, polled well in focus groups of average Americans and was encouraged by the work of Frank Luntz, the PR guru, who literally wrote the book on how the Republican Party should communicate with Americans. As instructed, I use the word choice frequently when drafting talking points. But those of us who held senior positions for the big insurers knew that one of the huge vulnerabilities of the system is its lack of choice. In the current system, folks, Americans cannot, in fact, pick their own doctors, specialists, or hospitals, at least not without incurring huge out-of-network bills. Oh, I love that out-of-network crap. Anyway, that's my aside. Not only does the current healthcare system deny you choice within the details of your plans, it also fails to provide many options for the plan itself. Most working Americans must select from a limited list made by their company's chosen insurance provider, paren, usually a high-deductible plan, or a higher deductible plan, close paren. What's more, once that choice is made, there are many restrictions around keeping it. You can lose coverage if your company changes its plan, or if you change jobs, or if you turn 26 and leave your parents' plan, among other scenarios. This presented a real problem for us in the industry. But well aware that we were losing the choice argument, my industry colleagues spent millions on lobbying, advertising, and spinning doctors, all intended to muddy the issue so Americans might believe that reform would somehow provide less choice. Recently, the industry launched a campaign called My Care, My Choice, aimed in part at convincing Americans that they have choice now and that government reform would restrict their freedom. That group has been spending large sums of advertising in, guess where? Iowa during this presidential race. Iowa, I hope you pay attention to this article. This isn't the first time the industry has made choice a big talking point as it fights health care reform. Soon after the Affordable Care Act was passed a decade ago, insurers formed the Choice and Competition Coalition and pushed states not to create insurance exchanges with better plans. What's different now is that it's the Democrats parroting the misleading choice talking points. Can I read that sentence again? What's different now, a decade later, is that it's Democrats parroting the misleading choice talking point and even using it as a weapon against one another. Back in my days, working in insurance public relations, this would have stunned me. It's why I believe my former colleagues are celebrating and toasting today. The truth, of course, is that Americans have little choice when it comes to managing their health care. Most can't choose their own plan or how long they retain it or even use it to select the doctor or hospital they prefer. But some reforms being discussed this election, such as Medicare for All, would provide these basic freedoms to users. In other words, the proposed reforms offer more choice than the status quo, not less. Let me read that one more time. In other words, the proposed reforms, a la Medicare for All, offer more choice than the status quo, not less. So here's my advice, says Wendell Potter, to voters. Is that if politicians tell you that they oppose reforming the healthcare system because they want to preserve your choice as a consumer, they don't know what the H they're talking about. Or worse, they're willfully ignoring the truth. Either way, the insurance industry is delighted. I would know. This article was written and posted at the New York Times on January 14th, 2020. Wendell Potter is a former vice president for corporate communications at Cigna. He is currently, however, a born-again president of business for Medicare for All and Medicare for All Now. I want to make sure that you heard every word of this article. I think this article should be turned into an informational ad. Understand why the insurance industry used the word choice, especially why it works so well. It's so seductive for Democrats to talk about choice. When I say the word choice, and you know I'm a Democrat, what do you assume? You think I'm talking about abortion. That we have a right to choose because it is our future, it is our bodies, we have a right to choose our destiny. So the word choice, almost by definition for Democrats, has a very positive response. And that's another reason why the insurance industry was able to seduce and buy the Democrats into basically selling this line of choice. I will post this article when we post this show today, but I just want to make sure how the health insurance industry invented the choice talking point. Wendell Potter knows because he helped them craft the lie. All right, that's Article 1. Now we turn to Article 2. We interviewed Bob Hennelly this week. We have grown to love and admire him. One, because he's a fabulous and thoughtful writer. And two, because he has such a sense of history. For those of you who don't remember, Bob Hennelly has written and reported for The Village Voice, for Pacifica Radio, for WNYC, for CBS Money Watch, and other outlets. He is currently a reporter for The Chief Leader, covering public unions and civil service in New York City. You can follow him on Twitter at Stuck Nation. But the piece I'm going to read is a piece that he wrote for Salon.com. And we talked a little bit about it this week with my interview with Bob. But as I said to him, I had posted this article on my personal Facebook page, and that almost every sentence in this article is a keeper. And recognizing that Monday is Martin Luther King's birthday, I want to prepare you for your weekend and how you should approach Monday's MLK Day. I'm going to give you a little aside, everyone. My very first floor fight in 1985, I'd gotten elected to the New Hampshire legislature in 1984. I show up with my baby Kirsten on my hip. I breastfeed on the floor of the New Hampshire legislature every day. She came with me for the first year. And the Congress had just passed Martin Luther King's birthday, and now it was for states to begin to consider it. So New Hampshire was one of those states that was willing to consider it. Well, I shouldn't say willing. Let me remind you, there are 400 members in the New Hampshire House. The night before the floor fight on Martin Luther King's birthday, it had come out of committee with a negative response from the committee. They did not move ought to pass. My friend, Catherine O'Brien, who also happened to be my seatmate in the New Hampshire legislature, calls me frantically on the phone the night before the floor fight. And I said, Catherine, what's the problem? She says, I need you to speak on the floor tomorrow. About what? I said. She said, I need you to speak in support of Martin Luther King's birthday. I said, well, of course I support it, but I didn't attend the committee hearing. I've never given a floor speech, Catherine. You must be able to find someone who's better at this. And Catherine says, if you don't join me on the floor, Arnie, I will be all alone. And I went, what? So that night, I wrote my very first speech for the New Hampshire legislature in support of Martin Luther King's birthday. That was 1985. Of the 400 members, I believe this is how many votes we got. 60. 60 out of 400 in support of recognizing Martin Luther King's birthday. Fast forward, the last state in the nation to recognize Martin Luther King's birthday was my state of New Hampshire. As I look back today, I am so proud that that was my first floor fight in the New Hampshire legislature. I wanted to make sure that you heard that story. All right, here is the piece. Reconciling Dr. King's 1968 dream and our 2020 nightmare. Bob Hennelly, Salon.com, January 12, 2020. This upcoming Martin Luther King Jr. Day promises to be an especially sad one, as evidenced by the deteriorating social circumstances, both at home and around the world. We have done a poor job living up to his legacy. And while we still have Dr. King's prophetic voice as a beacon, it feels like we somehow went into reverse, deep into a dystopian wilderness since he died. By my calculation, we are about as far from clearing of his promised land as we have been at any point in my 64 years. It feels like we somehow went into reverse, deep into a dystopian wilderness since he died. By my calculation, we are about as far from the clearing of his promised land as we have been at any point in my 64 years. Quote, when machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. Close quote. That was written by Dr. King in his last book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? He continued, quote, a civilization can flounder as readily in the face of moral and spiritual bankruptcy as it can through financial bankruptcy, close quote. As the billionaires train their fire hoses of their vast wealth on the Democratic presidential primary process to, quote, save capitalism as we know it. Progressives should keep in mind that Dr. King was a principled critic of capitalism. As Vincent Harding recounts in his introduction to Dr. King's seminal book, the civil rights leader famously said, quote, something is wrong with capitalism. There must be a better distribution of wealth, and maybe America must move toward, oh, shock of shocks, everyone, listen to the words, democratic socialism. He has been dead and buried for over half a century, and yet King prophesied where we are now in 2020. We have elevated to the presidency a man who used racial animus as a weapon to divide a nation so he could rule it. And now he is admitted to using the power of the military he now commands to kill so he can continue to stay in power. That corruption of our democracy by this bloodthirsty narcissist is unfathomable. And yet the corporate news media can't press too hard on the fact for fear of losing access to the tyrant who drives our news cycle. Trump now has the entire planet on edge, waiting for his next reckless act of self-preservation. Instead, the media is consigned to covering him with the, quote, trappings of his office, crediting him with seeking an off-ramp because he did not want to carpet bomb Iran. And as with their reporting on the Trump miracle economy, which of course only benefits the 1% in corporations, this mainstreaming of his criminality helps build the scaffolding for his reelection. During the Obama years, the corporate news media used the MLK inflection point as a kind of collective pat on the back for the American psyche. It reassured us as a nation that we are pretty far along on the path of being more tolerant, righteous, and a just nation. There was a poetic symmetry in 2008 when President Obama took the oath of office for the first time on the steps of the nation's capital, directly opposite the Lincoln Memorial, where 40 years earlier, Dr. King had given us our marching orders. At that point, the U.S. was years deep into a global war on terrorism ginned up by the George W. Bush administration and based on a calculated deception that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction and that it played a role in planning the 9/11 attacks. Over the arc of President Obama's 8 years, he essentially carried out the two most significant Bush-era policies when it came to the global war on terrorism, and the second, the bailing out of Wall Street at the expense of everybody else in response to the Great Recession. Thus, after 16 years of an ill-conceived continuum, the stage was set for the rise of populist Trump. Then candidate Trump promised to end the further notice wars and champion the cause of working class Americans abused by the elites who, in Trump's view, preferred foreigners to red-blooded Americans. The carrying cost of the further notice global war had been obscured from the American people in two important respects. With the post-Vietnam War abandonment of the draft and a shift to an all-volunteer military, the American people became increasingly disconnected from the stresses and strains on those that serve and their families. And the hundreds of billions expended for what was a post-Cold War play for U.S. global domination by the neocons was, don't forget, deliberately kept off budget by being categorized as overseas contingency operations on an emergency basis without an expiration date, putting them beyond the discipline of sequestration. Hiding the money was only part of the post-9/11 hijacking of our republic. By 1968, the Nixon administration was beginning to learn an important lesson from the mass protest against the war in Vietnam. That war had become so unpopular in no small part because it required a draft that drew on 2.2 million conscripts out of a potential pool of 27 million Americans. the year before an influential paper written by Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize winner who turned the markets into a religion, advocated for an all-volunteer army. Did you know that? Milton Friedman. Friedman's reasoning was foundational to President Nixon's creation of the Gates Commission, which he set along with Alan Greenspan, who was the chairman of the Federal Reserve from 87 until 2006. The report noted that advocates for retaining the draft worried that not requiring all Americans to have some skin in the waging of war would encourage military adventurism. The Gates Commission countered that an all-volunteer force would actually increase democratic participation in decisions concerning the use of military force and denied it would result in unchecked military aggressiveness. It's important to remember, as Professor Andrew Bacevich, an historian and retired career soldier, noted recently, the collapse of the tradition of the citizen soldier is a tradition that harkens back to the very beginning of the Republic and continued until Vietnam. The GIs who went ashore in Omaha Beach were not professionals. They were in it for the duration. And he goes on, that system continued with Korea. That system continued with Vietnam, too. And because of the folly of Vietnam and the anger of the American people, stimulated by that folly, the American people abandoned that tradition. In its place, we have, he believes, become comfortable with having a military largely detached from the people drawn from the very militant part of our society and sent out to wage wars that never end and are no longer tasked with discrete and tangible goals. Bacevich concludes that while Americans believe we have the greatest army on earth, the U.S. military rarely wins decisively in conflicts. Likewise, they rarely achieve the amorphic goals they're assigned. You know, goals like spreading democracy, eliminating terrorism, or bringing order. America's status as a perpetual war-fighting machine came after the end of the so-called Cold War, when policy experts held forums about the country that could have the opportunity to accomplish with the peace dividend what could be realized by the collapse of the Soviet Union. The leveling of the World Trade Center and the post-protect the endangered homeland consensus commandeered not just our wallets, but our imagination. In the America of 2020, the nation has never been more economically out of whack, with income inequality accelerating. Since the Great Recession, when Wall Street greed set into motion the evaporation of $20 trillion of American household wealth, the collapse was most keenly felt in African American households. And what is not widely appreciated is that the proliferation of federal debt and all other manner of household, medical, and student debt that have exploded since Dr. King's death are helping to fuel the wealth concentration that King warned us about. Thus, after 16 years of an ill-conceived continuum, the stage was set for the rise of populist Trump. Then-candidate Trump promised to end the further notice wars and champion the cause of working-class Americans abused by the elites who, in Trump's view, preferred foreigners to red-blooded Americans. The carrying cost of the further notice global wars had been obscured for the American people in two important respects. With the post-Vietnam War abandonment of the draft and the shift to an all-volunteer military, the American people became increasingly disconnected from the stresses and strains on those that serve and their families. As the percentage of union enrollment declined, so did American wages, and household debt exploded in place of real income growth. Meanwhile, our government itself was also being hollowed out by a growing debt addiction. In just 3 years, the interest payments on our federal government debt will be bigger than our annual military budget, which this year was close to $740 billion. Like a tapeworm, debt service is devouring the nation from within. It is only a boon to those who speculate in it and to Pentagon contractors who profit off the bulging military budgets. It offers a place for great wealth to protect itself by investing in the instruments that carry it, as it does in similar bond offerings floated at the municipal, county, and state levels of government. This is the great pyramid scheme, whereby every public improvement, airport, bridge, tunnel, or mass transit system has to tithe to investors who demand a piece of the action. But the ever-expanding dominion of debt has not just helped turn our government into a protection racket for the 1%. It has subjected an entire generation of young people that are shackled by $1.7 trillion in student debt. Many of them have no hope of repaying. And there is a cynical convergence of our debt machine and the recruiting of the volunteers to fight our further notice wars. As Vice reported, the Army met its recruiting goal last year in large measure by playing on the devastation wrought by the American student debt crisis. One of the national crises right now is student loans. So $31,000 is about the average, an Army recruiting commander, Major General Frank Muth, told Vice reporters. You can get out of the Army after 4 years, 100% paid for, state college, anywhere in the United States. In a society in which many believe that a lack of a college degree means consigning oneself to economic oblivion, young people are ripe for the picking. As Thomas Gokey, an activist with the Debt Collective, told Vice, debt is a form of social control. You can force people to do all kinds of things if you put them in debt first, including waging unjust wars, killing and hurting other people, and risking their own life and limbs. But debt, as social control, is not merely a tool used to capture the young. In a society in which many believe that a lack of a college degree means consigning oneself to economic oblivion, young people are ripe for the picking. As Thomas Gokey, an activist with the Debt Collective, told Vice, debt is a form of social control. You can force people to do all kinds of things if you put them in debt first, including waging unjust wars, killing and hurting other people. Debt is a form of social control. You can force people to do all kinds of things if you put them in debt first, including waging unjust wars, killing and hurting other people, and risking their own life and limbs. But debt as social control is not merely a tool used to capture the young. It increasingly subjugates the entire nation, particularly with the latest $1.7 trillion Trump GOP tax cuts for the 1% and corporations. These were enacted despite the spike in defense spending and even as we continue to ignore the existential threat of climate change. The same folks that profit from the existing system are now making the case that because of our massive federal debt run up to serve the military and corporations, we will have no choice but to reform Social Security, disability, food stamps, Medicare, and Medicaid. Reform, read that as cut and destroy. For our debt and its holders are our 21st century rulers. Without radical change, all of our choices at home and as a nation will be increasingly driven by servicing these indentures. For our debt and its holders are our 21st century rulers. Without radical change, all of our choices at home and as a nation will be increasingly driven by servicing these indentures from which there will be no redemption. Bob Hennelly, Salon.com. His article was entitled Reconciling Dr. King's 1968 Dream and Our 2020 Nightmare. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. See you next week.